Spirit Radio Podcasts.
There's now just 35 days until Brexit, and as the date gets closer with still no deal agreed, new political fault lines are appearing, and some of the economic implications, including Ireland, are coming into clearer focus. There's been reports this week of Britain's Food and Rural Affairs Secretary Michael Gove saying he's considering introducing non-tariff quotas for Brazilian beef. So what would that mean for Ireland? Well, Fianna Fáil's Derek O'Leary points out that the Irish beef sector was worth $5.25 billion a year, and 52% of its imports go to the UK, putting 1.25 billion of the economy, he says, at peril. Also, there was resignations this week in Westminster. So what's been happening there and what is going to happen next? Well, on the line to tell us a little bit more about some of these developments in relation to Brexit, we have our regular political analyst, Susan Phillips. Good morning, Susan. How are you?
Yeah, good morning, Wendy.
Well, let's start off with those resignations. Tell us a little bit about that and the background and what happened.
Well, I will, because basically British politics are kind of being reshaped before everybody's eyes. And just when you think it can't with Brexit get any more extraordinary in Westminster, last week we actually saw physical evidence of break-up divisions, not just within the House of Commons, which you'd expect, but within the two parties. And Wendy, eight MPs left the Labour Party first. Now, you would have thought it would probably have been the Conservatives first because of the Brexiteers, but it wasn't. Eight MPs left the Labour Party, citing anti-Semitic influences and practices, as well as a need for social market economy. Okay, what does that mean? What that actually means is it's a way of saying a pullback from Corbyn's Marxist rhetoric. You know, he wants nationalisation, and that isn't quite so popular with some of these members that left. But there was a Luciana Berger of Liverpool, who is Jewish, I think, and she just said she had been at the receiving end of huge anti-Semitic abuse and bullying. And if that wasn't enough, Wendy, we had three Conservative members left their party, citing that Mrs. May's policy for Brexit was inadequate and the destruction of the modernising wing of the party, whatever that meant. But in each case, and this is the interesting thing, the 3 plus 8 makes 11. And you actually saw pictures in Westminster of them all moving into benches to sit together, and they're calling themselves the independent group. So we have to say, are they being, is it very attractive? Do you think more people will be tempted? And then the end result is actually that right now Mrs. May holds a very slender majority anyway, including the DUP, and suddenly you've got, if you can call it a party, but you can call it a group, independent group, which is the same size as the Lib Dems.
Well, so, I was surprised it didn't receive more attention here in Ireland. I'm not sure what it was in the UK, but I would have thought it would have caused more of a stir. I'm sure it has for Theresa May.
It certainly has for her. And, you know, what's she going to do about this? Because that's quite a lot of votes, isn't it?
Well, indeed, this is it. So what sort of an impact do you think that's going to have for Theresa May over the next 35 days?
Well, I think that we've got to have a look at four different scenarios which can be affected or could be affected by her losing eight anyway. But either way, she's got a completely divided party. But, Wendy, there are a few choices. First of all, she could run down the clock. Now, you probably wonder, what does that mean? That means that you just get so near to crash out that when you hold the final vote, even though she can't get many changes from Brussels on the backstop, suddenly MPs, all Conservative MPs, and maybe a few Labour ones, they just panic about a crash out and they vote for her. And so therefore her present agreement, which perhaps possibly hasn't been changed much, goes through. So that's number one. The second one, that next week this could happen, there could be an amendment which is put forward by backbenchers which extends the departure. That's, you know, invoking Article 50 and perhaps for another 6 months or a year. And if that goes through, Mrs. May specifically said she won't tolerate that. So what does she do if it does go through? And that there are nine of her ministers who've actually warned her that they just couldn't tolerate a crash out. So the third one is that there's enough backbencher support for another referendum. And even Corbyn is sort of sounding a little bit warmer towards that idea. But the final idea, which could or could not happen, is that this week, and, you know, poor woman, she's backwards and forwards, that if Brussels would soften up, because don't forget, France and Germany are pressurising Brussels, soften up, okay, you've said you won't open the withdrawal agreement, but just tweak it enough with clarifications, call them reassurances, in relation to the backstop, that a majority of people in Westminster will vote for this slightly amended leave agreement. And then she can move forward and start the negotiations for what does trade do. I mean, that is the best hope. But it's kind of quite, you could say it's quite unlikely, because you've got to change the backstop. At the moment, what the Brexiteers are saying, well, even if you make the backstop, give it a time limit, you know, maybe later we can do a trade deal and you won't even need it. But it's so complicated, because the backstop says there will never be a hard border. If there is never a hard border, the north of Ireland has to stay within the customs union, and the DUP won't tolerate that.
So, Susan, in terms of Ireland, then, what's been in the headlines this week has been a bit of a different story, and this is in relation to what they're calling a possible trade war, and this is all about tariffs, or a lack of tariffs, when it comes to Brazilian beef. And basically, Ireland has kind of been used as a political pawn in the discussions on the backstop.
I think you're absolutely right, because if you look and see what the British Minister for Agriculture, Michael Gove, has said, and we'll just go through it again, but is he using the threat of tariffs on our Irish farmers as a leverage to get a more favourable deal for the UK? He could be hoping that there's such a big rural lobby here, and there is, that maybe they would exert pressure on our government that, you know, to say, look, hold on a minute, just give a little bit on this backstop. So we don't know, but, you know, as you said in your when you open the conversation, it is pretty serious, because $5 billion a year, which is 52% of imports, $5 billion is the beef sector, of which 52% goes to UK. So if you suddenly found that this threat of Britain favouring Brazilian beef over Irish beef by using a new system of quotas and tariffs, just say the UK is flooded with cheap Brazilian beef, and the Irish beef is not wanted. Yeah, that is a disaster, given the figures that we've just gone through. And to be fair to Fianna Fáil's Dara Cleary, he gives the figures, and he just says that this would be absolutely disastrous for Irish farmers. But you had the Taoiseach coming back, and Simon Coveney coming back, saying, oh, don't forget this wonderful EU fund that helps farmers if they're in distress. But, you know, tell that to Marines. You know, we've just seen what happens with the children's hospital figures. You know, people are going to say, well, hang on a minute, we don't really trust those figures. And farmers, how are we going to apply for money when suddenly our beef can't go to Britain? You know, it's not that great, is it, Wendy?
Well, in terms of, I think there's probably for many just ordinary farming families just reading these headlines this week, who have, I would imagine, and earlier reports this week saying just farming families feel totally in the dark and left behind. There's a huge amount of fear around Brexit for so many different industries and people. But what's going to happen next season?
Well, you see, don't forget, we are an agricultural country. So you could find out that suddenly there is tremendous pressure on, it's all down to the wire. We're down to, you know, we're in the 30s for days. What's going to happen? And of those four areas where I said one of four could happen, I would think, Wendy, that if Mrs. May can just get some proper tweaking on the backstop, I don't know how she'll do it, but if she could, if suddenly the DUP said, OK, we're happy enough, we're not delirious, but we'll go along with it, and other people say, OK, you've done your best, it's not a great scenario, it's not a great agreement, but actually it's so infinitely better than crashing out. And, you know, we could say, it was rather like, we've said it before, like the millennium. Do you remember just before 2000, everybody told us that every computer in the land would break, and it didn't. However, you only have to look at the ports, and you know, anybody that's brought anything in a trailer, a container, you go to the port and you show your papers and you just go pretty well straight through. That won't happen anymore. It'll be like it was in the 50s, 60s, 70s. You'll get out, you'll have to show your details, your quantities, the measurements, and suddenly there's a queue, and a massive queue to get even on the ferry. And then you get to the other end, and the British stop you and say, what are you bringing in? We want tariffs on your cars, on your goods, on your pharmaceuticals. So it really is so frightening that I go back to what I said before. I just do not think that the British MPs are going to stand by and let the vote result in an absolutely hard Brexit. On the other hand, Mrs. May's really running it down to the wire, isn't she?
Well, that's running it down to the wire is putting it mildly, Susan. So we're just going to have to keep our eye on the ball, even if it feels like some of our political representatives aren't doing that. Thanks for joining us on the programme this morning. That's our political analyst there, Susan Phillips. You might have heard it on our event guide or read it on our website. Over the past number of years, it's a really brilliant conference. I've been to it many, many times. It's a Divine Mercy Conference. It's in its 28th year, would you believe? And it's going to be taking place this weekend. It's running this weekend in the RDS in Dublin. And there's a youth event taking place this evening. And it's going to include some really interesting stuff, including testimonies by a former League of Ireland goalkeeper, along with music, talks, and just time to meet other people and talk about your faith. On the line to tell us a little bit more about this year's Divine Mercy Conference, we've got Katrina Heffernan. Katrina, morning to you.
Good morning, Wendy.
So tell us a little bit about the Divine Mercy Conference, and we'll start off maybe with the youth event this evening, because I know that's a new-ish addition, but it's obviously going well because they're keeping doing it year after year now.
Sure, I mean, the youth event is, it's like an extra add-on to the entire conference, which normally takes place on the Saturday and Sunday, but I suppose the organisers of the conference, in their wisdom, saw that they needed to pass this message on to the future generation. In line with, you know, a lot of what, you know, St. John Paul II was trying to do was pass on divine mercy to the new millennium. So it's really in tandem with that, that we're trying to organise as many young people as possible to understand what the message of divine mercy is all about, to come to the conference, to meet other young people in their faith, to have an encounter with Christ, and, you know, to basically, what we're hoping is that there'll be an overflow from the Friday night into the Saturday and the Sunday, so people get an entire jam-packed weekend of just grace and fellowship and enthusiasm for their faith. So the Friday night tonight is free for all young people. Anyone over 18, we're encouraging to come along and really just, you know, have that powerful encounter with other young people in their faith, to share that and to hear some really great witnesses. You know, as you mentioned, with Gerard Hanley, he's the former League of Ireland goalkeeper, and the brilliant Holy Family Mission. We have a healing service by Father Eunan MacDonald, and Father Hayden Williams is also coming all the way over from Malta. He's an amazing, charismatic Capuchin priest as well. So we're going to just lap up all the healing tonight, so we really are excited about it.
Katrina, for some young people who maybe haven't been to anything like this before, tell us a little bit about, I mean, your own experience attending events like this, just how it's helped you and your faith.
Sure, I mean, it's actually quite comical. My encounter with Divine Mercy, it tells you God's providence, was just shortly after Rag Week when I was in university in Galway, so you can just imagine the parallels there.
Oh, that was going,
you know,
on there, yeah.
From one extreme, and then it was just about the time of the annual novena in Galway, I had encountered a talk on Divine Mercy and what that was about, and that there was some diary floating around from some saint called Saint Faustina, and she really knew her stuff. So I just looked it up and tried to work through it. And what I was met with was more than I could really imagine, which is what Scripture tells us, that, you know, he will give us more than we can pray for or imagine. And when I picked up the diary for the first time, I suppose what jumped out at me was that Jesus spoke to this saint in Poland called Saint Faustina. And handily enough, the words in the diary, when Jesus speaks to her, is actually in bold writing. So it really does jump out with you. So when he speaks to her and says things like, "My daughter," it somehow lit a spark in my heart that, you know, this can be for me, it can be for her, it can be for whoever it is that's reading it or listening to it. So then I went on the path of figuring out what all this divine mercy was. To be honest, Wendy, it shows my ignorance, but I used to think it was just another holy picture of Jesus. You know, one minute he's the Sacred Heart, the other minute he's the Divine Mercy. And
I suppose it's one of those images that would be associated with kind of Irish households.
Yeah,
you know,
that's it, the Sacred Heart. I mean, it's just one of those things that you have to kind of read your way into to figure out that this actually happened in a time in history. You know, I suppose at the time in history that was really important for a very broken Europe, if you're to really understand it, which is just after or on the eve of World War II. And that's when this you know, miraculous image appeared to St. Faustina. You know, when Europe really needed it, they really needed to hear this message that, you know what, no matter what's going on in your life, and I say this for all the young people in Ireland today, that if they're feeling broken, like those people at the time, that if they're feeling, you know, that they don't know where to go, that they're looking for direction, that the divine mercy is the way to go. Because what I had to understand was mercy is a particular form of love. And that's why the Lord in his goodness and his wisdom gave it at that time of real brokenness. And I think, as you know, as JP2 would say, you know, now is an unprecedented time where we need mercy more than ever. A lot of people in our country are a little bit dismayed, maybe after the referendum and after all sorts of things, a lot of cleansing going on in our church. You know, it can be a time of brokenness, but it's also the greatest time of hope, you know, that this is really where the Lord can encounter the most broken of people. And I think that's just the genius of the Lord's plan, that he comes and just gives us this great love of mercy. You know, the first sin abounds, grace abounds all the more. So
it's
now
interesting,
is our time.
Just what you're saying, just in terms of the timeliness of it all, and I know that the theme for this year's event is "Let us not be put to the test, Jesus, I trust in you." I'm sure a lot of people will be thinking about how that relates to many things going on in their life. But what for a young person this evening who maybe has never been to any sort of what they would see as a religious event, but they're intrigued, they're interested, what could they expect?
Well, I just tell them, you know, to come with an open heart, because when I rocked into that church in Galway, I probably wasn't in a state of grace by any means. You know, I was coming with my student bag and, you know, looking every inch of a student. And what I was met with was just an openness and a wholesomeness. And it's one of those events, especially the Friday night, that you come in, you know, you're greeted with registration and you have a cup of tea, and it's all very informal, you know, to begin with, and you meet people. So I love these things because you can come on your own or you can come with friends, and nobody actually even bats an eyelid. And what you'll receive is just some really good teaching on what divine mercy is and what the faith is and why it's important today. And following on from that, we'll have an amazing healing service, really where we let the Lord do the work. You know, and so whatever people are going through, and we're all going through something, but it's really just to be able to hand that over and to come away really understanding and meaning the words of Jesus, I trust in you, where everything just becomes that bit easier. You know, our troubles don't really vanish overnight, but it becomes very, very doable and very, very bearable when you walk with the Lord in your daily struggles, you know, as we all have.
In the ups and downs, as you say. Of course, the youth event is kicking off the Divine Mercy Conference this evening, Katrina, but there's going to be lots of other stuff happening over the weekend. Tell us about that.
Yes, so, I mean, Divine Mercy Conference is one of those events that I actually look forward to annually, because it's like you're fed solid gold that nearly keeps you going for the entire year. But all these, you know, there's so many brilliant speakers. As I said, Father Hayden Williams coming over from Malta. I know there's numerous other speakers going to be happening. Another talk that Niamh Breen on the pro-life, and Father Brendan Walter doing the healing service. And it's just, it's like a marathon of, you know, of grace, really. And it's just held at a lovely pace. There's plenty of breaks. And also, it's just very, very well organized, that it's all the talks are recorded. It runs like clockwork. You know, you can have them as you go home, bring them to your friends, you know, and invite people along for the following year who couldn't make it this year. So it's a jam-packed weekend, but it's just a lovely atmosphere. When you walk into the RDS this weekend, there's something like the feeling of coming home, you know, that it's just like-minded people or people who are new to their faith or exploring their faith or well-established. It doesn't really matter what level you're at, but there is something for everyone. And I think you just won't be disappointed, anyone who comes along this weekend.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be a great weekend, and hopefully that you get that rest, rejuvenation and peace that you talked about. Katrina, thanks for joining us on the programme this
Wendy
morning.
Daddy.
That's Katrina Heffernan there, just telling us a little bit about the Divine Mercy Conference. As Katrina mentioned, the youth event starts tonight from 6:30. It's totally free for young people. Then the rest of the event runs on Saturday and Sunday, and you can get details of that at divinemercyconference.com. Our next guest is a theoretical physicist who did his PhD research on the topic of black holes. He's also a person of faith and doesn't see a conflict in believing in God and using science just to help us understand the universe. His PhD thesis starts with a note basically saying, "Thank you, God, for the faculty to uncover a page of the Maker's blueprint." What an interesting thing to talk about. I'm sure we'll talk about that in our chat. Well, in studio now to tell us more about the relationship between science and faith, we've Peter Taylor, who's is Assistant Professor of Theoretical Physics in the School of Mathematical Sciences at DCU. You see, Peter, I can barely say theoretical physics, which just shows how qualified you are to have this chat about science and faith. Tell us a little bit about that little note at the start of your thesis. Did you get any kind of raised eyebrows with that?
I'm not sure. Nobody ever said anything to me. I'm sure my PhD supervisor was curious. I felt it was right to put that note in there and to make a point to acknowledge that I got this mind from somewhere and I got this gift from somewhere, and there is an element of holy wonder in what I do, and even though I am, you know, exploring things using my intellect and using my mind, there's always in the back of my mind somewhere this idea that I'm really uncovering something that's bigger.
And you touched on a very important word, which is intellect. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that often people totally wrongly construe when they think of someone who has a Christian faith, that it's, you know, faith alone. There's no reason, there's no intellect. You think that's a common misconception?
Yeah, it's a huge misconception. And I think the problem is the perceived dichotomy between science and faith is actually a dichotomy between what you might call scientism and faith, or scientism and theism. And if I was to define those two things, you could say scientism is a belief system that science can and will eventually explain everything. So that's everything from the, you know, genesis and evolution of the universe, to the genesis and evolution of life, to all of your moral inclinations, and to your free will itself.
Do you think that's possible?
No, absolutely not. No, I don't think that's possible. And the real point is that that is itself a religious belief system.
Because you have faith, I suppose, in the science that went before you, the theories that went before you, in the, even down to, am I not to sound too sceptical, but, you know, well, who's funding the theories, the theses and all that sort of stuff. So, but you are believing in what went before. So it's ironic in a way, because if there's this perceived conflict between essentially two belief systems that often are trying to do the same thing, which is understanding why we're here and our purpose.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is just kind of understanding what science is, or maybe what it isn't. And I mean, the remit of science is really to come up with models that describe the physical world around us. I mean, it's not really part of its remit to answer whether all there is materialism. Do you know what I mean? So there's a big difference there, and I think people don't understand quite what science is, and like I said, more importantly, what it isn't. And this idea of scientism is really it's really a philosophy. It's really a religion, and it's an unprovable assumption, in the same way that any other religion is. It's a framework for understanding the world around us. Now it's a reductionist framework. It's a materialist framework. Whereas, you know, that's not the framework I adopt. I adopt a theistic framework. And then you can, I mean, there are going to be some areas in which science and observation and data will overlap with what the fundamental assumptions of your framework. So you do have to be rational, you do have to be critical, you do have to ask where the evidence leads. But I don't think science has given us anything that very obviously conflicts with the theistic perspective.
In terms of your field of study, I'd probably need a PhD just to understand it. You know, it's so complicated. Tell us a little bit more just about your study so far, Peter, and then connecting that up with your faith.
Yeah, so my main area of research is in black hole physics. So I basically explore this in two different areas, trying to understand quantum effects around black holes, and then also trying to understand things like signals for gravitational wave detectors. It's called a self-force problem, but usually again in the context of black holes. But I've also done some study on other areas like cosmology and some areas that maybe are a little bit more related to the bigger questions. And cosmology is particularly interesting because...
So that's looking at the planets, the stars, or...?
Cosmology is looking at the large-scale evolution of the universe. So basically from the genesis of the universe right through to its evolution on the largest scales. So this is the area where I guess you get most overlap between what a believer in God might claim and what a scientist might claim.
And do they conflict often?
No, actually this is the area where the evidence most naturally leads to a theistic perspective. And
what sort of evidence have you discovered that have helped you in that journey?
So it wasn't really me that discovered it, but the evidence that has been discovered, for example. What I should say is that this idea of a perceived conflict is a very modern one. I mean, it's only the last four or five decades.
Yeah, because historically, when you look at many scientists over the centuries, many of them were believers.
Most of the greats were driven by this idea that the universe is so ordered and there's such a beautiful law to how the universe works, so that there must be a lawgiver. That idea was maybe starting to deteriorate a little bit, and atheistic perspectives were kind of growing in favor among scientists in particular. And then in the 60s, we discovered that the universe had a beginning, and that really rocked the boat. Actually.
So this is the Big Bang theory, right?
Yeah.
Which was actually, I think, a French priest who came up with the theory.
Some of the ideas go back quite a long way, but the actual solid evidence for it came in the 60s by Penzias and Wilson, two observers, and this really shook things up a lot, actually, because once you know that the universe had a beginning, then it's basically a first principle of logic that it must have had a cause. And for some reason, there's a lot of believers think the Big Bang is a bad thing. This is something that we should throw out, something we should fight against.
But the Big Bang didn't bang itself.
Well, the whole point is that, if anything, this was very controversial back in the 60s, because scientists back then knew that this had massive theological implications, that if you know the universe has a beginning, you have to accept that it had a cause. I mean, we know no situations where this result isn't true, where something that begins to exist didn't first have a cause. I mean, if you don't accept that, then you have to believe that in this room where we're sitting right now, an elephant could pop into existence out of nowhere. Out of nothing. It's absolute madness. So everything that begins to exist must have a cause. And this agrees with, for example, the biblical interpretation of creation, or most monotheistic interpretations of the creation event. And it caused a stir in the 60s when this was discovered. And it caused a stir because the scientists understood, or atheistic scientists understood, that this had massive theological implications. And it made the position a bit more untenable from their perspective. Now they've since come up with some ideas to try circumvent this, and for example, maybe quantum gravity, if we ever discover such a theory, might circumvent this idea. But that's speculation. Right now, the consensus amongst physicists is that the universe had a beginning. And anything that has a beginning must have a cause.
And that's for you where the kind of faith side of it comes in and say, well, it is this intelligent designer who we call God.
Yeah, I mean, and that's only one piece of the puzzle. I mean, there's other arguments as well that come from cosmology as well. One of the strongest arguments is the fine-tuning argument. And this is this idea that the parameters for life to exist are so exquisitely balanced on a razor edge that they just couldn't have occurred by chance.
It's not an accident, in other words.
It's not an accident.
I remember hearing someone say, Peter, it's akin to saying it's an accident is akin to saying that there was an explosion in an alphabet factory and the dictionary just accidentally formed. You know, so
it's actually way worse than that.
It's even more mind-blowing.
So let me give you one example. So one of the parameters in the universe is called a cosmological constant. And this is the parameter that describes how the universe is expanding, if you like. It's like an outward pressure. And this parameter is fine-tuned to 1 part in 10 to the power of 120. So just to give you a sense of what that number is, so it's 120 zeros, so the first 120 decimal places are zero, and then the 121st decimal place is non-zero.
As our children would probably say, gazillion, bazillion.
Exactly. If this parameter is a tiny little bit larger, then the universe expands too quickly and you don't get any galaxies forming or structures forming in the universe. So you get no life in the universe. If it was exactly zero, this parameter, then the universe would have collapsed a long time ago. So the probability of this number being what it is by chance is 1 in 10 to the power of 120. Now, you can't really perceive of that number.
That's the thing. Is that one of the issues? It's hard for our kind of minds or intellects to kind of get around it. And so sometimes it's just easier. And is that one of the issues, to not explore these things at all and to just kind of put our heads in the sand?
Yeah, well, you can try to visualize, like, so I crunched some numbers on this to try visualize what this number would be like. So the way I think about it is, and this is topical because we had an Irish Euro Millions winner this week. So let's say you did the Euro Millions and you won. Now, you'd say you were a pretty lucky person.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say the next day you also did the Euro Millions and you won again. You'd say you're very lucky now at this point. Let's say you did it again and you won again. Now you're thinking you're...
what is going
the
on?
The luckiest person in the world. Let's say you existed for the entire age of the universe and you did the Euro Millions every day for the age of the universe and you won every single day. That's about the probability of this number being what it is.
So not probable
so
in
not
any way,
probable.
Shape or form.
And that's only one number. There's other numbers like the something called the entropy being very, 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 very low in the very early universe. And that's also exquisitely fine-tuned, even more fine-tuned than the cosmological constant.
The cosmological constant. Can't wait to bring that up at the next dinner table conversation when people start talking about the relationship between faith and science. I think certainly probably one of the things that, well, maybe you tell me, Peter, is that there's a kind of sense of wonder, you know, that our faith kind of gives us about the creation that God has given us. Do you think it actually makes, in a way, for you to be a better scientist, having that faith?
It certainly helps me appreciate it more. Whether it makes me a better scientist, I don't know, you'd have to ask my peers. It certainly makes me appreciate what I'm doing a whole lot more. And I tend to find a lot of beauty in what I do. So from that point of view, I find it very satisfying. And this, like I said, this was one of the big drives behind many of the great theoretical breakthroughs and amongst many of the great scientists back in the earlier days. It's only become a much more recent phenomenon that people have tended to separate the two.
Do you feel you're kind of in a minority in terms of being a theoretical physicist who also has a faith? I mean, do you get that question often, or do you get kind of people sneering at you when you talk about your faith?
I'd say I probably am in the minority, and increasingly in the minority, I would say. And I don't know if there's a selection bias there, because there's an increased perception that there is this dichotomy between science and faith, and so perhaps that means that less people of faith get into science. So that could be one explanation for why that's the case, because it certainly wasn't the case 100 years ago. In fact, 100 years ago, most of the great scientists were believers. So, I'd say I probably am in the minority now. I mean,
so when someone just asked that basic question, I mean, what's a good answer for people listening who are trying to articulate what you're saying when someone says, you know, science and faith are in conflict, and you would respond, science and faith are not in conflict, and here's why. What are the kind of key things for us to think about today?
Oh, that's a big question.
I know. We just still attend to, I don't know, one nugget of wisdom for us, Peter.
You know, I would say science and faith, by definition, can't be in conflict, because science, the remit of science, has little to do with what faith is pertaining to. But scientism and theism are in very sharp conflict. But the thing to appreciate there is both of those are unprovable assumptions. They're both systems of belief that help us frame the world around us. Now, that doesn't mean that every system of belief is intellectually tenable. It still has to agree with the evidence in as much as it can, and it still has to agree with empirical experience and all of those things. But there, there's just no issue with fate. I mean, we don't know of anything scientifically that says that this position is intellectually untenable. But it is a tricky one to get into, though, because if you're speaking to somebody who's maybe more scientifically informed than you, these conversations can be tricky to have, because they can tend to pull up things that maybe you're not aware
of. Yeah, and I think that's where people feel out of their depth. A good book, actually, that I'd recommend people, that certainly helped me, was written, I'm sure you've heard of him, Peter, by a scientist called Anthony Flew, was once kind of known as one of the foremost popular atheists, and he basically just followed his scientific belief to its end, and he agrees with Peter in that there is a creator of this magnificent universe. But it was very interesting to see how he was ostracized by his peers for kind of changing his position. And the book is called There Is No God. The no is crossed out, and I recommend it. It's a very good one, but it's quite meaty.
There is some great material out there. I liked for the layperson Lee Strobel's A Case for Creator.
Great,
that's a good book. Almost anything by Stephen C. Meyer is very good. He has a PhD in the philosophy of science. He's a really great apologist. Talks a lot about neo-Darwinism, and talks about the conflict between that perspective and, say, the Christian perspective.
We've got some light Friday night reading to do with those recommendations.
Yeah. So both of those would be good places to start.
Well, it's been really great to chat to Peter Taylor in studio. I'm always greatly encouraged, I hope you are too, when I get to interview people who are certainly a lot smarter than me and a lot better qualified on loads of different topics. You know, we've had economists this week, and now Peter, theoretical physicist, chatting to us about his faith and how faith and science don't conflict. It's great to be able to have these chats on Spirit Radio. And Peter teaches in the School of Mathematical Sciences at DCU. Peter, thanks for taking the time out to chat to us this morning. Well, we take safe drinking water, running out of our kitchen taps, for granted. And one of the things is just bottled water, isn't it? Filling the shelves and the amount of money we spend on them. But obviously, without water, we can't survive. And it's something that's hard for us here in Ireland, where water is so readily available, to get our heads around, is that so many communities around the world do not have access to a secure supply of safe drinking water. When our next guest visited Cameroon, he was met with people who only had dirty water to drink, and he was determined to change this for these communities. In studio to tell us more, we've Mick Toulon, the founder of Water for Cameroon. Mick, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So tell us about yourself and your background.
Well, I'm married to Joanne, who's from the US. We've been married for 47 years. We have 5 children. We're scattered all over the world. One is in Germany living and working there, 2 living and working in Australia. Our only daughter is in Ireland, and our youngest is in El Salvador.
So all over the world.
So
you're an international family.
Yes, yeah. So I worked in, born and raised in Dublin. Worked in Dublin all my life, worked in industry, and that business closed in 2002, and since that time I've been self-employed, and been enjoying that, and then got involved at Water for Cameroon.
So how did you end up in Cameroon in the first place?
Yeah, good question. I got to go visit some friends from the church that I attend, which is a Baptist church in Dublin City. They were there working on a translation and literacy program. So I went to just visit them and see how they were getting on. And when I was there, I saw a lot of the conditions in the general area where they were living, and thought that we could maybe do something about it.
Was it what you expected when you got there, just kind of life on the ground in Cameroon?
Well, I had a little bit of an idea from the Blackwells telling me about it. But again, when you see the conditions yourself, it comes home to you a bit more than hearing someone else talk about it. So when I came back from that visit, I talked to others in the church and rabbited on a bit about it, and eventually it was John Blackwell actually who said to me, well, why don't you do something about it? And I thought, well, no, should be someone else doing that, you know, the usual thing. Well, not me, because I had no background in that kind of thing at all. But anyway, decided to think about it and talk to my wife and see what she had to say, and she agreed that, yeah, if that's what I wanted to do, I could go back for another visit. So went for another visit.
You weren't making any commitments. You were like, I'll just see what happens.
Yeah,
next.
Yeah.
All right.
Oh, yeah. There was no big plan or anything like that. It was all, it's all of this has kind of grown generically, if you like. So that's how the second visit came about. And it was coming back after that, that I talked to Liz Rohn, who you may know in the church, to ask if she could help with fundraising, which she did. And it grew from there. And almost 30 visits later, we're still beavering along. And
obviously, the focus was water.
Yes.
So what was your kind of first goal, or what was your hope after your second visit? What did you want to do?
Yeah, we looked at what we could do in terms of constructing some wells and also providing and helping to have constructed things called biosand filters, which are a very cheap way of making this item that will purify the water. So we looked at that, we did that, and that's how we started out. And other little things have come to be added on to that, but they were the two and are still the two main parts of what we do. Yeah.
So in terms of then how Water for Cameroon grew, because I would imagine probably after your second visit, when you came back and said, oh, we'll do a bit of fundraising, you probably didn't think you'd be back there another 30 times.
Oh, no.
Tell us about how the story has evolved.
Well, again, it's coming back from that, what was the second visit, and talking to Liz and getting some funding going, decided that, look, we'll go for another visit and we see. And it just went on like that. There was no great sitting down, making a big plan. Well, we do so many visits. To some extent there was, but not really. We said we would try and make 30 wells over a period of, I think, 4 years.
And what's involved in that process when you say make a well? How complicated is it?
Yeah, good question. Because the typical wells are bored wells where somebody comes in, a big contractor comes in with a lorry, and within a day or two, there's a well there.
So they have to drill down to a certain depth to get clean water,
yeah,
essentially.
But we decided not to do that.
Okay.
And the reason we decided not to do that was we decided talking to the people and seeing what was happening with the wells typically that were arriving in locations around about the place, that these wells were breaking. They hadn't been trained most often to know how to repair them. So we talked with them and said, well, what about if we make a hand-dug well, which there are some there like this, but we worked on this, making a hand-dug well, which would be in diameter, inside diameter, about a meter. So quite a big size. It was concrete linings and things like that. And the idea being that if there would be a pump on this, but if the pump breaks, they can at least have access to the water with a rope and a bucket. Pretty basic, okay. But at least they can get the water. Whereas the bore well, if it breaks, unless they can get it fixed quickly, there's no water is going to come out of
it. And obviously there's resources involved in that and practical issues then. So you were trying to make it as sustainable as possible,
essentially.
Exactly,
yeah. And that's one of the big problems all over Africa and other places, that first of all, to have people trained that can repair these things, and then to actually get the parts. Because it's for you and I, if something happens in our house, we go down to a local store, buy the bits and bobs, or have a plumber come and do it, and it's all hunky-dory. But they're different kettle of fish. Someone might have to travel for a day, perhaps, to find, if they can find the stuff, maybe come back and say, well, you know what, that part wasn't there, and that costs money, and communities get frustrated. Well, we gave money to get this and it's not working, and so on. So that was the thinking behind that.
What sort of an impact does the lack of access to clean water have on people's lives and communities?
It's huge, because typically they take water from what you and I would call a ditch or a pool, and they're most often not protected. By that I mean there's no fence around them or anything like that. So animals can come and be sitting in them and everything like that. So they'll come and they'll take their water, and they let it settle, and thinking when the dirt goes to the bottom,
and try and filter the water.
They try and filter it, but it's not really filtering at all. The bacteria is still in there, so it's a huge thing having to drink that kind of water. There's diarrhea problems, there's stomach upset problems. They spend huge amounts of time in the hospital. All the hospitals, you have to pay. Now, it's a relatively small amount of money, but when you're going regularly, it adds up. And, you know, the families are biggish, you know, 5-6 more children, and all of those going to the hospital, and the time taken to get there. and transport to go to the hospital. So you add all of that up and you've got a lot of money and you've got a lot of sick people. So having safe water and teaching them how to store it, you know, getting the safe water out of the well is one thing, but often people can have it contaminated by the time they get back to their home. They leave it in an open basin or something like that. Chickens or something come in and poop in it or whatever, and you know.
So there's a whole education piece as well, you know.
Yeah.
And what sort of impact then, Mick, have you seen with the locations where you've been able to put some of these wells and fresh water in have on local communities?
Well, one example that comes to mind is a school that we helped put a well in with and some of the filters. And we put in six filters, one for each class. And the kids, the bigger kids, were trained how to take the water from the well. Even though the water from the well would be pure, we still wanted to be absolutely certain in this instance. And this was a kind of a test in a way. And as it happened, the headmaster was very, very good at wanting to do this. And he, interestingly, which is rather unusual, he had a chart in his office of kids who were out sick through stomach illnesses and things like that. And after we put it in, and about 6 months when I was back the next time, the figures had dropped dramatically of kids being off. And I asked him, well, how can you be sure that it's because of this? And he said, well, that the only reason they were getting sick was because he showed me the place they were getting the water from prior to the well, and it was a horrible place. So he was absolutely convinced that this had helped them significantly. So that's just one little example.
And how many people would be able to get water from one of the wells that you've built then?
Yeah, good question. There's about 500 people, at least that. You know, they'll come from roundabout and be in and around 500 people. Yeah, and
you've done over 60 now at this stage.
To date, there's about 70 wells.
Wow.
Yeah, either being constructed from scratch or rehabilitated, ones that were broken, and we got them going again.
Presumably, one of the biggest things that you need is support, financial and other types of support. What's your kind of message to people listening? I know you're going to have an AGM that people can come along to and learn more about your work.
Yeah, we have an AGM coming up on Thursday, March the 21st, and we'd like to invite anyone who's interested, who's listening, to come along. We'd like to find out more, or perhaps even get involved. That would be great. And anyone who would like to contribute in any way, if they go onto the website, watervercameroon.com, there's a way there they can do that, and we'd appreciate that. Our funders are very small and few, and the work we're doing there is small in the scheme of things. We're very small.
What does it cost to make one well?
About €3,500.
Okay.
Yeah. And we're a registered Irish charity, but we're very, very small. You know, very, very small. It's just a handful of people on a voluntary basis.
But the impact when you think of €3,500 providing clean water for 500 people is huge.
It is. Oh, it's absolutely huge.
And scandalous when you think of what we spend on bottled water. You know, if you put it into that context.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So we just tip along, beaver along, doing what we can. And we'll continue to do that.
Is your faith one of the things that motivates you to keep going?
Yeah, well, that was what was the thing for me that brought it along. You know, you think we have things so good, and as Christians, we should be thinking more of others than ourselves, really. And that would be a big factor for me, absolutely, yeah.
Well, it's very inspiring to hear about the work that you've done, and I'm sure the people of Cameroon who have access to those 70-plus wells are glad you went back for the second visit, and many more since then. I've been talking to Mick Toolan from Water for Cameroon. As Mick mentioned, there is an AGM taking place on March 21st, very aptly just before World Water Day on the 22nd. If you want to find out more about the work that they do, you want to indeed head along to that AGM to find out more, you can go to the website waterforcameroon.com. Mick, thanks for joining us on Spirit
Thank
Radio. God bless
much.
You and the work
Thank
that
you.
You're doing.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.